You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. Coming up on our show, we'll be talking with three guests about opportunity zones that were created as part of the 2017 federal tax cut bill. The act establishes a new tax break meant to encourage investment in low-income areas. But if not planned and enacted carefully, the law may not help residents of those zones and could actually harm communities. But first, it's back to school time in Arkansas. And for some Arkansas kids, back to school also means back to after school programs. From homework help to healthy eating to building robots, after school programs can play a critical role in children's education and their success in school. We are joined by two guests to talk about after school programs in Arkansas and their impact. State Representative Fred Love, who was recently elected House Minority Leader, and Levita Wills-Hale, Director of Arkansas Out of School Network. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
To start off with, what are the role of after-school programs for children in Arkansas?
Well, first of all, let me say good afternoon to everyone. I will tell you this, I'm with a great guest, Miss Wills, because she is like the foremost advocate for after school or out of school network time. And so I'm going to defer to her, but I will say this, you know, the roles of after school programs is vital to families, but they're vital to children because they can get that intense educational time that they may be missing in school. And so if we implement after school programs correctly, they are just an extension to educational time. And so let me defer to Miss Will so that she can go ahead and
thank you so much, Minority Leader Love, for that. And I just want to dovetail with what you just said, because I do think while it's an opportunity to extend the learning in those cognitive skills, most often referred to as academic skills or hard skills, it's also an opportunity to develop the whole child. And so in most quality, and I want to emphasize quality after school programs, they're taking a comprehensive approach, which focuses on not only their cognitive development, literacy, math, but also social and emotional learning and getting along with their peers and learning how to collaborate and work in a team are critical. And as you know, these are work-based skills that are needed in the modern workplace. You often hear them referred to as 21st century skills. It's also an opportunity for young people to exhibit leadership. The young person who may or may not be the president of this club or that club in school can still be a leader in his or her after-school program. And so when we think about the four C's, communication, collaboration, creativity, and critical thinking, that hands-on experience in after-school is invaluable to developing young people. And so after-schools are a critical part of the education pipeline in Arkansas.
And so where are after-school programs in Arkansas? Where are they located? Are they at schools? Are they at churches? How do they differ from program to program?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, as you know, you have the traditional, the boys club, the boys and girls clubs. You also have boys and girls scouts and different places like that. But you also have the faith-based community taking part. I know here in Pulaski County, the faith-based community has stepped up to run quality after-school programming. And so I would say you have a hodgepodge of networks providing after school programs, but you also, and I'll leave it to Miss Wills to tell you, you also have a deficit of quality after school programs in the Delta and Southern Arkansas.
I think you couldn't have said it better, Representative Love. And what we know is that there is absolutely no, the positive benefit of after school and summer programs is while we know that they're very much focused on achieving real outcomes and having real impacts on children. But we know that there's no cookie-cutter approach. And quite frankly, we think that's the strongest, that's a strength. Mm-hmm. Because after-school programs, whether they're a school-based program, like a 21st Century Community Learning Center that's based in a school, we have several here in Pulaski County. We have a total of 80 of those around the state, serving about 12,000 kids. But we also have community-based organizations, and I'm thinking about programs here in Arkansas and in the Lower Delta in Northwest Arkansas that are nonprofits who are just coming together with community stakeholders to cobble together funding to serve children. And so There's no one size fits all, but here's the thing that we know for certain, that a good program has intentional structure, intentional programming that's built on best practices in youth development. Some examples of that might be what 4-H does with STEM and robotics, or what other programs may be doing in the area of arts programming. Or many of the programs are focusing heavily right now on computer science and coding and using verified curriculum and supports through Google First coding clubs, or the work to focus intentionally on computer science and computer literacy with girls through things like Girls Who Code. So there are a myriad of opportunities for structured, intentional, fun, hands-on, engaging learning that occurs in out-of-school time or after-school programs across the state.
And could you talk a bit, like, a bit more in depth about just a couple examples of, sure, of two kind of different programs?
Absolutely.
That are both really great?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about a program in Northwest Arkansas. It's called SOAR, and it's run by an organization called Camp War Eagle, and they have several locations, one in Springdale, several around the Rogers and Bentonville area. And one of the things that they focus very much so is on kind of like this career pathways programming to really get kids ready for life. And so they focus very much on social skills and life skills. They're a part of something called the Great American Shake, which is really just building up those interpersonal skills in young people. It's a national effort to ensure that young people feel valued, that they are ready, whether that's thinking about what their opportunities are in the job or workforce, or thinking about just taking a more active leadership role for themselves. But it's really focusing in on those skills. Mm-hmm. And then I think about programs like the Boys and Girls Club in Saline County, ran by Jason Kelly, and they're focusing very much on robotics.
One of Representative Love's colleagues.
Yes, one of his colleagues, and they also have what I used to call, I told them to stop calling it a garden. It's really an outdoor learning space, which where they grow produce, they sell it in the farmer's market. They learn a whole host of skills, and they work with partners like Cooperative Extension. And I just really must put a plug in for UALR, Children International. They're the only domestic program in the United States run by Children International that focuses on out-of-school time. And children as young as 5 are developing business plans for products that have a public good. So, for instance, they're developing a business plan to sell greeting cards, and they take it from the design to the marketing, and then they develop a board. And these are kids who are in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, who are learning these skills that many adults, quite frankly, don't know or have. They sell these programs at the farmer's market and then donate the proceeds back to charity. So those are three very different models, but as Representative Love knows, they're all working towards the same goal.
And I will add something, because this is something that kids, you know, I don't think adults, I'm going to say adults, mm-hmm, focus on, because there are just some core competencies that kids can develop. Mm-hmm. You know, they're developing their character, they're developing their competence, they're developing their confidence. In these programs, when you learn to master certain skills, like in STEM, kids are developing confidence, you know. And so these are some of the things that they may not get in the traditional, you know, school environment. However, when you have the school environment working with the after-school and out-of-school environment, these are the skills that are developed by kids. And so this is why the out-of-school and after-school is so important to the educational fabric of our kids right now.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we're talking about the impact of after-school programs in Arkansas. If you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And so it sounds like there are a lot of hands-on learning opportunities. It may not just be what we think of traditionally for after-school programs where, you know, they're just playing outside, which is very valuable, but or just playing outside or doing, you know, their homework after school, which is also very valuable, and having that opportunity to, you know, get a personalized help with homework too. But there's a lot of different types of programs.
So Rebecca, I do want to add one thing, because I do think it's important for our listening audience and the general public to understand that after school and summer programs have been around for a long time in the United States. Boys and Girls Clubs are over 100 years old. So are all of our scouting initiatives, and so is 4-H. But and so as the field has grown, so has the evidence or the research base that supports it. Mm-hmm. And so what we're talking about, it may seem kind of lighthearted, but what we now know is that we have solid, and I want to say long-term, but a researcher would say longitudinal evidence that after-school programs actually do a couple of things. And so the first thing that they do is that they contribute to better attendance, better behavior in school, so fewer behavioral infractions, right? And better grades overall, and particularly in the area of reading and math. Then we also know that some of our latest research says that the social and emotional development of young people, researchers Durlock and Weisberg, indicate that, quite frankly, it's not an either-or contest between social and emotional development and academics. It's actually one supports the other. And so that evidence base is growing and continues to get stronger, and we're seeing these findings be validated in our programs, like some of our 21st Century Community Learning Center programs and other programs around the state.
We talk about that a lot with early childhood education too, the importance of social emotional learning and a child's overall success in school and things like that. Levita, you talked about the four C's for programs, and that there's a difference between quality after school programs and programs that may not be quality after school programs. So if there's a parent listening, how can they determine if a program is a quality program that they'd want to put their child in?
So I'm going to say, I'm going to step back in my role as now great aunt and auntie and a surrogate parent. The first thing is paramount is the safety and well-being of the child. And most parents want to be assured that their children are safe, and I understand that. I think the second thing is that you want to be sure that you have adults working in that program who've had some training and who understand child development and youth development, that they understand how to engage the children. And I would say, I think it's important that programs have a structure, that they know when things start, they know when things end, that they know what the boundaries are, because that contributes to the program environment. And then the other thing, so we call that structure and clear limits in jargon in our world. The other thing, though, I think it's really important to have a solid curriculum. You know, we say to out-of-school time professionals, for instance, in the area of STEM, you don't have to be a physicist or a rocket scientist, but let's get a valid, good curriculum that is not just a one-off, but we're looking at what does your calendar look like in your program. A parent should be able to say, okay, so it's September now, but what's going to happen in December? What's my child going to be doing? And so that program should have some idea of the structure and the flow, not just month to month, but they should have their year planned out. So it's planning, it's structure, and then it should be fun, you know? I mean, I don't want my child, I want my child to learn, and certainly there should be evidence that the child or the young person is going to learn some new skills or reinforce skills that occur that are learned during the school day. But I want it to be fun and engaging and feels like the child can get along with their peers so that they know how to handle conflict and You know, if there are consequences, that they are appropriate and age appropriate. Mm-hmm. And so parents, first of all, ought to feel free that they can answer questions. If you go into a program and they don't want to answer your questions, that's a red flag for me.
Yeah.
And if they can't answer these basic questions and be conversant about what their program is trying to achieve, then that program still has some work to do, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You're a parent, representative.
I would definitely agree, because I mean, just as a parent, you know, when I go in to talk to my sons whenever he's at Scouts or whatever extracurricular activity that he's taking part in, these are the main questions I'm asking.
Yeah.
Because I want to make sure that he's getting that quality. And I guess I can't put a big enough emphasis on quality, because we're looking at quality, because there are after school and out of school programs there. But we're looking for the quality, so that that quality can be an extension of what they get during the school year. So,
and build upon that.
Yes.
Not duplicate mm-hmm. it, but build upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing that I'm thinking as you're talking, Representative Love, thank you, that another thing is, you know, do you have a relationship with the school? You know, do you have the ability to share information back and forth, so that it's mm-hmm. a really team effort, and that it's not competition between after school and school? It's
yeah.
how can we support this child, how can we support these parents? And really, what we know is that parents, actually 74% of Arkansas parents say that after school program gives them peace of mind, and 89% of the parents of Arkansas parents who have mm-hmm. children in after school program are satisfied with that. That's a really high rate.
Mm-hmm.
And for those parents out there who have questions about how to communicate with our school time provider, we would be glad to help them figure out how to select, choose, and if necessary, refer them and point them in the right direction.
Great. And that leads me to my next question. How many kids participate in after-school programs in Arkansas? Do we have enough slots?
Yeah.
And are there regions, and Representative Love already kind of touched on this at the beginning of the show, are there regions of the state where programs are less accessible? So, and then fourth question's well, part
I'm
of that.
I'm going to answer yeah. this really quickly, because I know Representative Love has been looking at this issue along with some of his other colleagues in the legislature. But one of the things that we know, and we do a survey with our national partner, the After School Alliance, and so the data is showing that right now we have room to grow. That's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 65,000 students statewide, K through 12, who do participate. Now, the bad news is because of there are not enough slots, because we just don't have enough funding currently.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know is when we survey parents, that about 190,000 kids would, which would take us from 13% participation in Arkansas to about 45%. So we
oh,
have
wow.
room to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is that we know where we have holes and gaps, and Representative Love may want to reiterate where those are, because he did a great job of that.
We have holes to funding. No. But I will tell you this, that yes, as we look across the state, and I guess I don't want to talk about it so much as in slots, because mm-hmm. I mean, but just having those points of access to have those quality programs there,
mm-hmm.
you can look and see that where there's kids going to school and they don't have anything after school, quality after school programs that they can attend. And so I think funding is going to be a big part of that. Back in 2011, the legislature did pass a framework for after school, quality after school programs. However, we did not pass an appropriation to fund this framework. And so, you know, these are investments in our children that we must make. It's not really an option of can we make them, because if we want our kids to be competitive, because we're in a global society, then these are investments that we must make. And so we must begin to prioritize after school, just like we prioritize adequacy in any other part of educational funding, so that we can ensure that kids are having quality after school programs.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to add and just reiterate, the largest concentration of programs are where the population centers are in our state. So we have more programs in Central Arkansas. We have more programs in Northwest Arkansas. I am very much concerned about the whole Delta region of our state, and really from Pine Bluff all the way across, so South Arkansas in general. A lot of this just has to do with where our program infrastructure is, and Representative Love talked about the Positive Youth Development Grant Program Act 166. But this is a human issue, and if I just can take 30 seconds. I was on a call, and this is really tough. I had a grandmother who just found out 2 weeks ago that her grandchildren were going to be with her on a permanent basis. And this grandmother is facing a health crisis and had exhausted all of her family leave, so she had to go back to work. She called us the Friday before Labor Day and said, I need a program for my two grandchildren, and those children just happen to be special needs. And I was so grateful that I was able to take her call and give her some peace of mind and connect her. Fortunately, she was here in the Little Rock area, and we had options, right?
Yeah.
But had we not been in Little Rock and maybe not had those options, and I was able to connect her with some additional supports from the state that she might qualify to help with the children. But, you know, I can only think what she would have had to do. She would have had to choose between maybe working and losing her job and not having aftercare, quality aftercare for those two precious children. I received another call from a dear friend from Montrose, Arkansas, which is just miles away, a stone's throw away from Lake Village in Arkansas. And this dear sweet lady, she won't mind me calling her name, Miss Henrietta Curtis, is taking funds out of her pocket to provide an after school and summer program. And this year, that community came together this past summer to feed the children. And I put her in touch with some folks who can help with that. But they still need the quality engagement that a structured after-school program can provide. Those are two examples. So this is a human impact. But it also is costing us as Representative Love, because we've got to prepare those children in those areas so that if we want to be the job magnet and the economic development engine, it's going to take the workforce. And I am the child of a working-class parent. And I know my parents wanted much more for me than I could have ever imagined for myself. But they stressed the hard work, and I had opportunities that I could take advantage of in my community that prepared me for the job that I have today. So this is so important, and it's so personal for many people.
And in Arkansas, students, you know, our state struggles with our grade level reading numbers and our math literacy numbers. So it sounds like you said earlier in the show that it's been proven to increase grades in math and reading. So it seems like it's a pretty smart investment for some issues that we know for a fact our state has.
You know, I'm going to tell you, it's a smart investment because it's an economic, this is an economic development issue. The number one thing that any company looks for is the workforce. And if you don't have a thriving workforce, then you cannot attract the businesses that are necessary to keep your economy powered. If you cannot have the jobs here, guess what the kids are going to do? They're going to leave. And so this issue in and of itself is an economic development issue. And so we must, as I said, and I'm going to continue to hammer it, we must invest in our kids. We must invest in these high-quality programs so that our children, number one, that we are growing the workforce that is necessary to power our economy, but number two, so that we can compete globally for the jobs and the businesses, but that we can just compete globally, period.
We have just about 3 minutes left for this segment of our show.
Goodness, 3 minutes.
Yes, we've
already
had a very good conversation. Already? Yes. But to wrap up, can you talk, LaVita, about what the out-of-school network is and how you already said that one thing that you do is you can help parents and guardians mm-hmm. connect with resources. Can you talk more about sure. your work and how people can connect with you and become advocates also?
Absolutely. I'd love to do that very quickly. So the Arkansas Out of School Network is one of the 50 statewide after school networks throughout the United States. Each state has one. We are it in Arkansas. We're a sponsored initiative of Arkansas State University within the College of Education, and our mission is simple. We want to make sure that young people have safe, quality, enriching learning experiences when they're not in school. We provide technical assistance and training and professional development for programs. We support programs with community-wide planning to implement quality after-school and summer programs. But most importantly, we are an advocacy organization, which means that we work with our wonderful policymakers like Representative Love to find solutions in state through the state budget to support quality after school. We also work with our federal policymakers and communicate with them. So anyone out there can reach me at 501-660-1012 or visit our website at AOSN.org for further information. We'll work with any program at no cost to them, and we're willing to work with messaging and putting together their communications. The one thing that I'll wrap up and say is that we need to do a better job, parents, program providers, and other interested parties, in telling the success stories of after school and summer programs. And we need those stakeholders to reach out to their policymakers, such as Representative Love, to tell these success stories and let them know why these programs matter and why we need to fund the Positive Youth Development Grant Program Act.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. The next part of our show is pre-recorded, so you won't be able to call in with questions, but you can find out more information about Opportunity Zones on our website at aradvocates.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We are back with three guests, Ryan Davis, board member at Arkansas Advocates, Marty North Hamilton, also board member at Arkansas Advocates, and Bruno Showers, Arkansas Advocates Senior Policy Analyst, to talk about opportunity zones and their impact on communities. Thank you all so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Let's start with a simple question. What are opportunity zones?
So, I tried to explain them in the simplest way possible. Opportunity zones are basically census tracts that governors submitted for approval for these particular designation. The interesting thing to me about opportunity zones is you have to separate them from the idea of the former enterprise or empowerment zones, where there had to be a direct impact or benefit to the community in which the census tracts were identified. Opportunity zones, in contrast, are basically a capital gain tax shelter for individuals who are trying to reduce simply their capital gains tax. So wealthier individuals are trying to find a mechanism to direct dollars to lower their federal income tax liability. The type of projects that they invest in and the mechanism by which they create the projects or locate the projects do not have to have a direct benefit on the community in which they're located, and there's no requirement to get community input, feedback, approval, none of those things. The opportunity is for the investor. That's the simplest way I can describe opportunity zones.
Okay. Any?
I agree. it certainly is a little, it's, you know, on the nose in terms of how they title it, because it is an opportunity for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And, I agree with Marty. I mean, you know, based out of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, this is an opportunity for investors to receive federal tax incentives. And one of those ways is, certainly commercial development, but for real estate development, the bar is low. All you have to do is prove that you've substantially improved a piece of property, and you know, there's no real definition as to what that means. You substantially improve a piece of real estate and it becomes a tax shelter for you until 2026.
So how is the law, how is this is this how it was framed when it was coming out, this Opportunity Zone Act or law? Was this the stated purpose of it, or is this just how it's actually being implemented?
I think it was designed this way to begin with. I mean, it's just based on sort of, I think, a pretty common logic that we see, which is, you know, that investment will sort of trickle down to people in the area and it'll help them indirectly, whereas the direct benefit goes to the investors.
It was definitely intentional and deliberate in design, the way that it is currently structured. And every few months, they are putting more substance to the rules, because mm-hmm. for so long, it was sitting out here like, what do you do with it? How do you make it work? And investments weren't really happening mm-hmm. because you really couldn't figure out what do you invest in and how. And so rules keep developing. But no, if you really look at the tax policy and mindset, as far as we can tell, of taxes, mm-hmm. this idea that if, as Bruno had pointed out, if you give tax breaks to certain wealthier individuals, that there will be this amazing trickle down opportunity, and that and if these investments come into these communities, that no matter what it is, it's mm-hmm. going to improve those communities. That's the theory.
And so you were talking, Marty, about the rules are coming out, additional rules every month or so. Who's deciding those rules? Do those vary from zone to zone? Does the governor's office decide that? Is that being decided at a national level?
That's being decided nationally out of D.C. There's actually a council and a committee that works on this, and they're getting feedback from all of, I think it's 17 or 18 different government agencies mm-hmm. and some other business people are giving them insight. And there's a lot of feedback and commentary that's going to the White House as it relates to what would work, what's ideal, some things to consider mm-hmm. structurally, especially as we're talking tax code, which is extremely complicated. So one of the other issues when you're thinking about these projects, not only is there the tax shelter, but when we're talking about investments at this level, the investors are expecting and practically demanding a particular rate of return on this investment. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the challenges I have in talking with a lot of nonprofit organizations. They're like, oh, here's a great opportunity for these investors to invest in us. And I'm like, probably not going to happen mm-hmm. because you can't give them a rate of return on that investment. They're not looking for charitable gifts. They're looking for, is it a 10% ROI on this thing? Is it 17%? What is the return on that investment mm-hmm. In addition to the tax break? So that's another one of those complicating factors that makes it totally different than the previous zones like enterprise and empowerment.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about that, if I may, Marty. So I heard here that one of the sort of issues with trying to get investment in opportunity zones is sort of the timeline that it requires as well, right? Because to really realize most of the benefits, you have to at least hold on to your investment for like 5, 7, and then 10 years mm-hmm. to get them all. And I don't know anything about investment banking, but that seems like a long timeline to me.
Actually, it's not. Okay. The issue is how quickly they've got to make these initial investments. That's the problematic part. The holding part is not the issue. It's this compressed timeline, unless they change the rules, to give more time to get it monies invested. And so when you think about these opportunity zones, and I hate to be absorbing all the air on this topic, every opportunity zone is in competition with each other when you think about it. So the way it is structured, either you can organize your own fund and go through all of that hassle to organize a fund, or you can invest in one of the existing national funds that quickly organized. And so they're going to be looking for projects that are pretty much already in a pipeline that they can already see what the return would be. And as you can imagine, the initial investments are looking at the usual major metropolitan areas. When you think of the Amazon deciding to keep that one location in New York, aha, opportunity zone. Here's, let's go over the tax ramifications of doing that versus moving it to Virginia, California. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally the really big places. So there's a belief that there are large portions of the country that none of these funds will actually touch. And so if a local community wants to figure out how to utilize this designation, they're going to have to figure it out on their own.
So I think Little Rock has a committee for opportunity zones. Where are the opportunity zones in Little Rock? Is there just one? Are there multiple ones? And what is that committee doing? And what's the city's plan for that zone or zones?
I know that some of the opportunity zones, well, all of the opportunity zones at this point in Little Rock are east of I-30, north of I-440, which is inclusive of the East Village and the Clinton National Airport, the Petaway neighborhood, the 12th Street corridor. And, you know, I think specifically of, you know, East Little Rock, known as I was growing up as the East End, but now known as the East Village, which is a really quaint name. They've come a long way. And, you know, a lot of these opportunity zones are based on data from the 2010 census. So we're talking about areas that have potentially gentrified by now. If you look at some of the development west of the what they call the viaduct, which is really a train bridge in the East Village, I mean, you know, that area is being quickly developed. I mean, there are charter schools, restaurants, breweries, and other such things there. But now you potentially have, for people who are in the midst of developing or preparing to develop, you know, these great tax incentives. And so a lot of those folks who live on the other side of that that levy, mm-hmm. you know, they're potentially going to be priced out of there.
So as it pertains to the Little Rock Opportunity Zone Task Force, I happen to be vice chair. And we are about to begin our work. We went on a tour with the representative from the White House, and a few other DC individuals came down. So when you're trying to visualize, like Ryan had said, out by the Clinton Airport, very industrial area. So that has a certain vibe to it, development opportunities to develop in that area. East Village, that has its own opportunity. Off of 12th Street, a couple of census tracts, and it's not all the way down the 12th Street corridor. Mm-hmm. It's like track 18 over here, and you jump and it's a tract over there, which are more residential and small business driven, which is going to really take a certain level of intentionality to make that work. Mm-hmm. Now, I cannot say what the task force is going to come back providing as recommendations mm-hmm. or suggestions, but I can tell you what I hope happens. Mm-hmm. I think here locally, whether it's Little Rock or any other community, we have to look at what tools the city government currently has and try to come up with incentives to try to get local individuals with capital gains to consider projects or working with the community and the city to make certain desirable projects happen. Because if you're not intentional, unintended consequences result. Mm-hmm. And so I see East Village, as Ryan had pointed out, one side of it we really think of as East Village. The other side, with Hanger Hill and the other, that's a totally different reality. But I think there's opportunities for investment there that naturally are going to be attractive to someone who, if they were looking to invest in an opportunity zone here, because there's already momentum there. And some of these other areas is going to take more vision and effort to spur interest and to create projects, in my opinion.
And so the locations that opportunity zones are they meant to counteract some bad policies in the past, like redlining and others? We did a show about this. People are shaking their heads. We did a show about this last month to fix those, not fix, but spur investment in those areas that for so long have not had the opportunity to get investment because of racist policies. And you see that play out in Black communities, Latinx communities over many decades. Is that the underlining purpose of this? And if not...
I would say no, yeah. No, indeed. In fact, I would say that, you know, the Opportunity Zone seemed to take advantage of the historical effects of redlining, because redlining created these distressed neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so now you're saying to people that, you know, we created these neighborhoods, and now here's an opportunity for you, if you don't mind the hyperbole, to come and vulture off of the effects of redlining. You know, with the permanent exclusion of taxable income and new gains. I mean, people hold this property and they don't, you know, they don't contribute to the school system. It's odd to me that none of our Opportunity Zones connect to any of the major health institutions, not to UAMS, not to Children's Hospital, not to, you know, any of those places. And so, I mean, I see here, you know, kind of a very purposeful lack of financial and institutional support to the neighborhoods per se. I mean, maybe to the sidewalks and to the buildings, but not to the people in the neighborhoods.
So it's, I mean, the businesses that are already there or people in those communities that would like to start businesses, it doesn't sound like this program is meant for them.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how somebody like a Peter's Catfish, how they survive. I don't know. I don't know specifically where the Opportunity Zones are. I know that they're on 12th Street. How do they survive, you know, that kind of development? Or do they decide, well, you know, here's an opportunity to sell out, not in the pejorative way, but to literally to sell out and to move on. And mm-hmm. then somebody brings in something that the people who live there can't afford, and you know, for the tax incentive, or they bring the building and they improve it for years, and you know, you just kind of have some vacancies there.
Is that possible, Marty? You were talking about, you know, some of these areas have a lot of, it's mostly residential. So is it possible that people come in and buy up houses and raise the rental values of those homes and impact the community in that way?
So from an investment strategy currently, if someone were wanting to redirect and invest in one of those census tracts with high residential, they would probably do it in multifamily. Mm-hmm. So if they acquired very, very, very low entry point housing and land and raise them and put in apartments, there'd be absolutely no requirement that they consider the current residence or income levels of the area. So if you're not really careful with opportunity zones, they could be another tool for gentrification. Mm-hmm. And Ryan pointed out something that I think needs to be addressed. The city of Little Rock submitted, I think it was like 20 different census tracts to the governor. Mm-hmm. So the governor selected and approved all of the census tracts in the state of Arkansas. Now, Arkansas, to the best of my understanding, all of the tracts that were selected were predominantly considered to be low to moderate income census tracts. But mm-hmm. there wasn't a requirement for all of them to be. So in some parts of the country, some of the tracts aren't low to moderate income either. So you also have, so you have the situation of why none of the census tracts in Southwest Little Rock were selected. The city of Little Rock submitted some of those tracts. They weren't selected. Mm-hmm. So there was that second level. So the municipalities did their analysis and said, here are the tracts that we recommend. They went to the governor's office, whatever process they use, and they said, well, these are the ones that we're going to move forward. So you have that. Mm-hmm. 12th Street corridor, I don't know, because there's always a lot of different plans and thoughts about that corridor and connecting it to the new Midtown. So there's that opportunity depending upon the old Sears site, you know, all that's developing there, some activity connecting it maybe to UA Little Rock and some of its initiatives going that way, pick up Madison Heights, if it ever gets phase three, the Children's Library, 12th Street Corridor, if they can ever get somebody to go in there with the police, I think it ought to be a donut and coffee shop. I know that's stereotypical, but I know it would work. And then you have the empowerment, the center that BCD has, and you kind of have these hodgepodge one thing off. So if something could spur something else, it spurs something else, maybe can make a bridge between those institutions.
I told Bruno earlier before you came in, Marty, that I was encouraged that Mayor Scott said one thing in particular that not heard from other mayors, and that he said very specifically, we don't want to talk about gentrification. I think I'm hopeful in that respect that, you know, we could quite possibly be talking about changing the narrative, because, I mean, the possibility does exist. Now, you know, of course, this is, again, on the face, just an investment opportunity. But perhaps with the pulpit of the mayor, something different can happen in the empowerment, the opportunity zones in Little Rock.
So I'm kind of interested in what that would look like, just because I think we've kind of spoken around this fundamental tension between how do we attract investment, because as you mentioned, the easiest thing to do is buy basically fallow land, green development, and put up a big apartment complex at market rate, right? But that doesn't help anyone in the community. Mm-hmm. Now, we could say you need to set aside a certain amount of affordable housing with any multi-family development, but then that's less attractive to investors, and we're already apparently having trouble getting that kind of attention. So how do we thread that needle?
So I think that's one of the challenges and opportunities when we're looking at, no pun intended, opportunities, to look at all the different tools. For example, low income housing tax credits are a possibility. New market tax credits, Arkansas Capital just got another allocation. How can we think and leverage zoning? I mean, just a lot of different things. Is there some other sources we can pull together to say, okay, here are a lot of different tools, if leveraged together, create that return on investment that you're looking for that would help accomplish a need? But I think we also need to make sure that we're hearing from the community in some way, because what you wouldn't want to see, or I would hate to see anyway, someone says, oh, we need to put another McDonald's or fast food restaurant in a neighborhood that was saying we don't want anymore, but the debt service and all of these things work on paper. But there's nothing that would prohibit that from happening right now. They don't have to get, as long as it's zoned and you go through all of the regular development process, you could have businesses pop up that you didn't want in that community and push others out. But let's be very clear. When we use the term gentrification, there are two types. There's positive gentrification and there's negative gentrification. What you don't want to see happen is negative gentrification. Positive is, in the event, I use the old downtown Argenta adage, where you had one property owner, 30, 40 pieces of property, who was running an hourly business, if you know what I mean. To get rid of that landowner and take ownership of those properties and put them in to productive use, affordable housing, that's positive gentrification, because you're getting rid of a nuisance in your community. Negative, on the flip side, is when you're pushing people out, as Ryan mentioned earlier. And then the problem with pushing people out is, where do they go next? Mm-hmm. You have destroyed social structures, health, communications, transportation, and for a short-term gain that has been shown year and decade upon decade, the individuals normally end off in worse shape. They don't end off in better shape. So if I own a meager house that was worth $40,000 in this community, I can't go someplace else and buy a $40,000 house and be free and clear. So that's negative gentrification. So I'm hoping that we will be able to hopefully come up with like a clearinghouse and resources and opportunities, and then try to make various fund managers aware of these opportunities. So if there are doctors with capital gains here locally, for example, who are looking for an opportunity and want to do good, that we can present some opportunities to say, here is a project you can invest with. Here is how you would make this type of development work. That's what I'm hoping happens.
So I'll make that my final question. Continue on that point, like, what are policies, like these different kinds of zoning, that we can do to make sure that, you know, investment in communities is equitable and not just, you know, another policy like redlining that's going to hurt communities for decades and just pile on to the problems that they already have. What are some ideas to make sure that, you know, I mean, this is happening. What are ways that we can make it equitable, and are there ways and just have to do totally other different things to make it equitable?
You know, as Marty mentioned, you know, the thing that the city did not have control over is where those opportunity zones were placed, or were chosen rather by the governor. But, you know, looking into some of those places, I mean, I wonder actually if we could incentivize, you know, someone who would be willing to, and, you know, I'm speaking out of school, out of my league, but someone who would be willing to invest in something like a grocery store. There's not a grocery store in the 12th Street Corridor. The two closest are either down Colonel Glenn or 17th and Main. So you're talking about quite a few miles without, you know, a viable grocery store.
And it's a very basic community need.
Very much so, yeah. So, I mean, I wonder if there's a way for the city to, within the confines of the Federal Opportunity Zone Act, to incentivize something like a grocery store to, you know, add on top of the very explicit tax breaks that, you know, someone would get for developing property for something like that, you know, some other incentive. Now, honestly, I also know that there's no real incentive to running a grocery store, you know, these days in particular, but I don't know.
I would say, and we can talk at another time about grocery store and food deserts and why those exist and some of the challenges. That's when I put on my banker's hat, and it's a whole different reality to that. I think coming up with incentives for kind of nearby. For example, Philander Smith College needs student housing. They're not in an opportunity zone. But there's one of them not far from Philander Smith College and Arkansas Baptist. So I'm like, okay, is there an opportunity for us to find an incentive to help it make help Philander accomplish that housing need? Improve that some of the land that they have, incentivize someone to have that could have a great return on investment for creating some really quality student housing and solving a long-term need. I'm hoping we can find some of those type of opportunities, and then making various groups aware, like having a clearinghouse of these type of opportunities and maybe showing people what's possible. Because think about it, a lot of people with capital gains in this community or elsewhere are not really going to be visionaries into what could be. They want someone to tell them, this is the project, and my investing X number of dollars is going to return me this on the backside of it. So I'm hoping opportunities, I hate to keep using that word, these type of desires and needs within community that aren't relatively big lifts could be possible if we work together to make them attractive and make people aware and make the numbers work at the end of the day.
I'm kind of skeptical on how much we can really control or, you know, mitigate some of the downsides of opportunity zones, just because most of the research I've seen in terms of place-based policies are that if you do induce economic development or like new jobs, it's pretty costly in terms of the tax dollars that you've lost by allowing for this preferential capital gains treatment. And that's often, you know, the capital gains tax isn't what the tipping point is for investing in a certain area or in a certain business. My personal, like, I guess, bias would be to try and ensure that the community benefits in some direct way. Like I said, I like the idea of affordable housing set-asides. I understand that there's a tension there, but I kind of like that, or a promise of direct public investments in some sort of, you know, worker-facing service or something that just doing things that help the broader community in a more direct way than this kind of tenuous connection between rich person investing people locally benefit. I think there's a couple of different like things to think about, but I don't have like a silver bullet of what that would be. I think, you know, we've kind of spoken to the fact that I think it's going to be a lot of work to try and braid together different programs and different kinds of policies to ensure that the community benefits.
And then the worst, well, I won't say the worst, another option is that no dollars come at all. Mm-hmm. See, everyone forgets, just because you're labeled an opportunity zone does not mean a single dollar of investment is coming to that particular area either. So it could be designated and never receive any funds, which is another belief that's going to happen in large sections of the country. The more rural you are, the less likely that there's going to be an investment made into those census tracts. So we don't know. It's the big unknown as it relates to our local community. And we just got to see and speak up and educate people as much as possible.
Birmingham, I think, under Randall Woodfin, is doing some pretty good, pretty progressive, quote-unquote progressive community engagement, public-private partnership with Opportunity Zone. So if, like, listeners are interested, I would look into the big program there. It's Birmingham Innovation Group or something like that that's kind of directing their Opportunity Zone program.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left, and it does sound kind of worrisome that, again, I mean, we've said opportunity many, many times, but it sounds like there's a possibility, again, like if this isn't done very carefully, it could hurt communities and could just be one other oppressive policy that hurts communities. And so what are ways that Bruno was saying, go look at what Birmingham's doing, and what are ways that people, especially people that live in these communities, what can they do to be part of this process and have their voices heard?
You know, a phrase that I'm kind of tiring of is this idea that there's zero ethical consumption under capitalism, you know, which I might be just evidence of postmodern malaise, but I think
that's a different show.
That there might be, that there are opportunities here for, right, for us to reimagine this, because I mean, it's what we have. And I mean, you know, yeah. I guess, you know, we could have an administration, you know, who could say we just reject opportunity zones, we're not going to do anything with them, and we won't offer anything. But
yeah,
that doesn't mean people won't use them for their benefit. So we know that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's up to the citizens, and it's going to take a lot of education, and, you know, a lot of cajoling the body politic for us to understand what those opportunities are. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I keep saying I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm also very realistic about, you know, what this means. I think we know, like,